Our custom is to pause a few moments for silent prayer, enabling you to utilize the privacy of the priesthood and rebound if necessary, and to check your problems at the door, including the fact we're behind one to nothing. Shall we pray? Father, we are indeed grateful to you for permitting us the privilege of gathering here this evening in order to continue our development of thought based on your immutable word. It is our prayer that the passage we're about to examine will be made very viable to us as we study it, that it would contain information that would enable us not only to make our own personal soul inventory and to identify our own shortcomings, but also to discern when others are using us in the field of iconoclastic arrogance. All of these things designed to assist us make proper decisions in the heat of battle called the angelic conflict. And we lift our prayers in the name of Christ our Savior. Amen. Well, this evening I have a target as a place I want to get to in our study, and once we get there, we'll stop. We could be early, which will, of course, thrill those who want to get to a radio. But we could be late. Who knows? We'll see what happens. We need to go back and review the corrected translation of what we've done so far in paragraph D of our study of iconoclastic arrogance. And paragraph D is simply an illustration of this phenomenon. It includes quite a number of things as we've evaluated along the way, but iconoclastic arrogance is the essence of our study. And we're emphasizing 2 Samuel chapter 13, verses 20 through 29. And we've made a little bit of progress. Let's note the couple of verses that we've already not actually exegeted, but I have given you the corrected translation from exegesis. 2 Samuel 13, verse 20. Then her brother, the her here, the pronoun, as you know, refers to Tamar, who has been raped by her half-brother Amnon. Then her brother Absalom said to her, "Has your brother Amnon been with you?" And the "been with you" is simply an idiom here for "have you been raped by your half-brother?" And of course the answer is "yes, I have." "Now therefore, my sister, do not plan any revenge, for he is your brother. Put this matter out of your mind." And then we can see verse 21, which comes up next. And what has occurred between verses 20 and 21 is that the crime has been made known to David. And we have studied how Absalom maintained his poise and his dignity. He was able to manage his emotions, his lust patterns, his trends, for he did not care much for Amnon in the first place, but this crime was one that was absolutely unbelievable, that he would do this kind of thing. And he envisions that justice is going to be served. His father is not only king, but he is chief justice of the Israeli Supreme Court. And he is going to see to it that justice is served. And so when we get to verse 21, David is aware of all of the details involving the case. Now, when King David heard all these things, he became extremely angry. And then on Sunday, second session, we brought into view a second sentence attached to verse 21, which is found in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was accomplished in approximately 280 B.C. And in toto, the entire verse would read, "Now when King David heard all these things, he became extremely angry, but he did not trouble the life of Amnon his son, because he loved him, and because he was his firstborn." And that gives us the rationales that David had to let Amnon simply go free. Amnon became a 10th century B.C. O.J. Simpson. He raped the woman, and he walked. Fortunately for him, or I should say at least for Tamar, he did not cut her throat. 2 Samuel 13:22. we did a little work in that. Absalom did not speak to Amnon, either good or evil, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. Well, we do have some emotional sins popping up now. Justice is not served, and therefore hatred comes to the fore. He's never really liked Amnon, but now it is serious. He has found that David, his father, has revealed his feet of clay. He had made an idol out of his father. He assumed his father was perfect and that he would execute perfect justice. David's failure is reacted to by Absalom. But instead of striking out at his father directly, he does the next best thing. He focuses his attention on Amnon, the crown prince, whose position both through birth and politics enabled him to violate his sister with apparent impunity. Therefore, Amnon was a self-centered boor whose only goal in life was self-aggrandizement. Whatever his first husband wanted, his first husband got. Interestingly enough, Absalom was just as self-centered as Amnon, the difference being that where Amnon was lascivious, Absalom was ascetic. This breeds conflict anywhere it occurs, and here we have it in the same household. You have two brothers, one is lascivious, one is ascetic, and they don't like each other as a result because their trends don't match. And then when the lascivious brother raped the full sister of Absalom, his self-righteous trends came to the fore, and especially after there was a miscarriage of justice by his icon, his role model, his father David. So because of role model arrogance and unrealistic expectations, Absalom enters into iconoclastic arrogance. Circumstances prevent him from destroying his father directly, but he can go after him indirectly while at the same time avenging his sister's rape. And therefore, Absalom decides to murder Amnon. He enters into revenge motivation and revenge tactics. His revenge tactics are molded by his personality and the lifestyle he leads as a royal aristocrat. Now, resuming our study at verse 19, we'll note some of the things that go on in Absalom's life that contribute to his self-centeredness. Some people are handsome from birth. It's all a genetic thing. The soul is the issue, and God imputes the soul to the body. And then the body develops, and some guys are handsome, and some guys aren't. Some guys can go deep. Some guys have to be single-sitters. I mean, you have to know your limitations. Figure out what you got, and then go with it. Well, Absalom is one of these guys that if he had been a sports enthusiast, he would have been the star running back. He would have batted fourth in the lineup, and he would have been probably the center on the basketball team. And on top of that, when the game was over, he could have his choice of the women to go out with. We learn all of this. I'm not making this up. We learn all this from 2 Samuel 14, verse 25. That verse says, "Now in all Israel there was no one as handsome as Absalom, nor was there anyone so highly praised. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him." The verse is telling us that he was a stud muffin. Point 20. Absalom's personality is summed up very well, I think, by Dr. Herbert Lockyer in his volume entitled All the Men of the Bible. This is a series of volumes that is called the All series. And there's a little snippet, a little biographical sketch on all the men of the Bible. And there's another volume on all the women of the Bible. And then all the kings and queens and so on it goes. This comes from the volume On the Men, page 30, in his commentary on Absalom. He says that his handsome appearance was accepted by his handsome appearance was accented by his aristocratic poise, his commanding presence, his natural dignity, his extraordinary graces, all of which work together to make him a person of charm, eloquence, and persuasiveness, which won him the hearts of all Israel. Not only was he good-looking, he was a slick-tongued rascal. He could make people believe him. and ultimately many will follow him in a revolution. He is able to effectively communicate his ideas, outline his plans, and do so in such a way as to motivate people to follow him. He is respected, he is admired, and the women, of course, they fall all over themselves. And we're going to find out after he murders Amnon, and after he foments revolution against his father, that he indeed has a criminal mind. But I would imagine that if circumstances were right, he could run for president in this country and get elected, and the largest constituency that would support him would be the women. And why is that? Because Absalom would be perfect for television. He's good-looking and he's slick-tongued. He knows how to phrase things and he has the flair of aristocracy. So all he needed was TV. If they had television in 10th century B.C. Israel, he would not have had to have fomented a revolution. He could have just slick-tongued the people into getting rid of David and hiring him. So I guess maybe that little snippet of information is valuable to at least Bob Dole, if no one else. That this is how you get elected. By the way, this is how you get elected today. You don't have to know anything. You don't have to stand for anything. Can you appear on TV and look believable? And do you have character traits? I mean by that your personality traits, your mannerisms, the way you carry yourself. Can you exhibit yourself in a TV environment in a way that makes women like you? Well, if you can, run for president. It doesn't matter what you think, what you believe. None of that really matters anymore. Point 21. While displaying the impeccable deportment of a statesman, Absalom was in the interlocking system of arrogance. We know that from hatred, verse 22. Hatred simply opens the door, and from that spews, in this context, iconoclastic, conspiratorial, and criminal arrogance. And it all develops in this 8-chapter segment that I pointed out to you. The context begins in chapter 11 and runs all the way through chapter 18. And you could make a movie of this if you could have to put Spielberg on it. It'd have to be a miniseries. You'd need about 8 to 12 hours to get it done right. And you could start in chapter 11 with the rape of Bathsheba and run all the way through the revolution. And the things that you would be able to portray on the screen, the emotions, the mental attitudes, the conspiracies, the behind-the-scenes activities, Hushai the Archite, who is a spy for David, Ahithophel, who is the brains behind the revolution. All of these personalities come out in this 8-chapter segment. It's a fascinating study, and the doctrines which underlie the entire segment of Scripture are just probably would amount to at least 100, I would imagine. We could spend quite a number of years on those 8 chapters. Well, point 22, quietly and unrelentingly, Absalom plotted the demise of Amnon behind a facade of good manners. I'm telling you that if a person is a person of integrity, manners mean something. But if they are degenerate, it is a facade and they're up to something. Just because a person smiles and sounds believable, just because a person is kind and considerate and uses good manners, that does not mean that what they're up to is right and what they're saying is true. And that certainly is the case for Absalom. Everything he did was designed to get him to a moment in time. And that moment in time was where he could have his men, his staff, his bodyguards, assassinate Amnon. Everything he does is geared toward that date. That is the philosophy of a lot of politicians in our day. They will say anything they have to say and do anything they have to do in order to gain a given objective. And we have people in our country who vote for that kind of person because they have a worldview in which they believe it is more important than the means which are required to get there. The means can be evil, they can be degenerate, they can be against the law, but that doesn't matter. The end we hope to accomplish is going to create so much value and prosperity and freedom and equality for our people that a few mistakes and bumps and hitches along the way in the area of means really don't matter, because the end will justify it after it's all over. And so as far as Absalom is concerned, he hates Amnon to the very core of his soul, but he wants more to murder him than he does to tell him what he thinks at the moment. And so he's nice to him. He's kind. He's considerate. He uses manners in every possible way. He never lets on at any point for 2 solid years that he has a mental attitude problem with his brother Amnon. As far as anybody knows, he's forgiven Amnon for the rape of his sister. He's forgiven his father for the miscarriage of justice. Nobody has a clue. So quietly and unrelentingly, Absalom plotted the demise of Amnon behind a facade of good manners. Point 23. Already self-absorbed, David's failure to execute justice enables Absalom to self-justify and murder Amnon. Absalom is self-absorbed. I mean, the women have at least contributed a great deal to that, because they woo over him and swoon and what have you. And then, of course, he has great power, being a prince. Not the crown prince, but he is a prince. He has aristocratic background, and therefore he has aristocratic bearing and poise and savoir-faire. He is well-liked because of his personality, and so he is very self-absorbed. David's failure to execute justice therefore enables Absalom to self-justify the murder of Amnon. I am right about doing this. He is guilty of this crime. My father did not execute justice. Therefore, I am justified in doing so. And he will take the law into his own hands. 24. He is also in self-deception, since he rationalizes that he is justified in organizing a conspiracy. The conspiracy designed to perform the assassination. So the self-deception is that he is justified in carrying through the assassination. That all of these things are appropriate and legitimate. He's deceived himself into believing that. And thus he goes forward with a conspiracy to assassinate. 25. Hatred for Amnon got it started following the emergence of the feet of clay syndrome. And so we go back to where David is put up on the pedestal. He is the role model. And there David stands. And he looks on his father as perfect. My father is perfect, and I honor him. I have made him my role model. And therefore, up on the pedestal he goes. Then there is Amnon raping Tamar. And then we have David miscarrying justice with Amnon. He did not perform his duty here. This causes Absalom to go into role model arrogance. My father is not perfect. How dare him let me and Tamar down in this circumstance? He is not worthy to be on the pedestal. I will strike him down. Now David has tumbled off, and the pedestal, you will note, is empty. Who is it that is qualified through perfection to get back up on the pedestal and be the hero? The hero can be only a person who is perfect, and in self-absorption, Absalom qualifies. So he places himself up there, and from this arrogance, he is going to foment a revolution. I can rule Israel because I'm perfect and my father isn't. That's been proved in the case with Amnon and Tamar. So hatred for Amnon is what got it all started. See, everything was fine. We have role model arrogance here where David miscarries the justice, and not only do we have the tearing down of the icon, we direct hatred toward Amnon. And we're going to do 2 things here. We're going to destroy David, and we're going to get Amnon. Hatred is the mental attitude sin that started this ball rolling. That's verse 22. 26. Now Absalom functions under revenge motivation and is obsessed with destroying Amnon in order to discredit David. He is functioning under revenge motivation. He is obsessed with destroying Amnon in order to discredit David. David's feet of clay have poked up real high, and that has contributed to this whole milieu of sins. And now we're down here where Absalom is trying to crawl up on the pedestal. His hatred for Amnon got it started following the emergence of the feet of clay syndrome. He functions under revenge motivation, obsessed with destroying Amnon and discrediting his father. 27. In so doing, he will accomplish two objectives. Number one, he will avenge his sister Tamar. And two, push David off his pedestal as icon of Israel. David is imperfect. He must be pushed off the pedestal. Amnon is guilty. He must be dealt with accordingly. Now 2 Samuel 13, verse 23. Corrected translation. 2 years later, when Absalom's sheep shearers were at Baal Hazor, Absalom invited to a party all the sons of the king. Well, this is going to take a little bit of explanation. What in the world has the fact that there are sheep shearers in Baal Hazor got to do with inviting all the brothers to a party? Well, point one. After 2 years of minding his manners and thus creating the impression that he had adjusted to Tamar's rape and David's jurisprudence, Absalom begins to put his conspiracy plot into action. Notice the verse leads off by saying 2 years later. He minded his manners for 2 solid years, never giving anybody a clue he was upset. But now it's time to put the plan into action. So he minded his manners. He had created the impression that he had adjusted to Tamar's rape and to David's jurisprudence. He considered it to be bad jurisprudence. Now the plot goes into action. Point two. Some 90 miles north of Jerusalem. Let's put the Med in here, and this is the eastern shore of the Med, and we go over here. Oh, I guess right around here would be about right for Jerusalem. And then you have the Jordan River, and then you have what's known as the Sea of Galilee. It was called the Sea of Kinnereth at the time. And then north of that, the Jordan goes, and run into another diagram. Dadgummit. On up the Jordan goes. And then right along in here is a city called Hazor, H-A-Z-O-R. And this is the Jordan. And over here is Geshur, Kingdom of Geshur. So note Jerusalem is down here. And you go north, you pass the Sea of Galilee or Kinnereth, and then you go north a little further to Hazor, and it's on the west side of the Jordan, and Geshur's on the east side. So now point two. Some 90 miles north of Jerusalem, beyond the Sea of Galilee, known then as the Sea of Kinnereth, and to the west of the Jordan River, is a city named Hazor. And on the outskirts, there is a temple to the Phoenician god Baal. So somewhere in the outskirts of Hazor is a temple to Baal. That's B-A-A-L. Hazor is H-A-Z-O-R. Geshur, G-E-S-H-U-R. Point three. And so to the east of the Jordan was the country of Geshur, whose king was Absalom's grandfather Talmai, T-A-L-M-A-I. That's his grandfather. He runs the show over there. Now note, his father's down in Jerusalem, He's up at Hazor, a couple of miles across the river, and he's in his grandfather's kingdom. Point four. It was at Baal Hazor that Absalom owned a sheep ranch where each year, following the annual shearing, it was customary to have a big party. All these guys would come in, these professional shearers, and all these herds would come in that had been growing their wool, however long sheep grow wool. These sheep come in and these professional shearers are going to shear these sheep. And once they're done, it obviously takes quite a while and it's hard work. When it's done, everybody gathers around some big bonfire, I gather. They have a party. The party could last for several days. But it is a customary event. It's conducted annually. So point five. It was at this customary outing that Absalom decided would be the setting for his assassination of his brother Amnon. That's where he's going to do it. Not in Jerusalem, and we'll note some of the rationales as to why not. Not in Jerusalem, but at Hazor. But he's got to get Amnon up to Hazor. How do you do that? It's not his ranch. Amnon, I'd be willing to bet Amnon would not go within 500 yards of a sheep. I'd be willing to bet that Amnon would not do anything that even looked like it might have labor involved. I would predict that Amnon, the crown prince, is going to be out partying and letting the loose end drag at every possible opportunity. And the idea of going out into the woods to be around a bunch of sheep shearers and have a barbecue around a bonfire is the last thing he's got on his mind. So how do you get this old boy up to Hazor? Point six. In order not to arouse any suspicions, Absalom first invited all of his brothers. He's going to make it a family affair. We're going to have us a family reunion at Hazor. And everybody's going to be there. Isn't this going to be neat? And we'll all gather around the little bonfire and we'll have us a barbecue and we'll hold hands and throw faggots on the fire and sing Do Lord. And all of us will just get a little, we'll have the glow of rose and get that little tingle up our spine and we'll all just be one great big happy family. So I start out by doing a guest list. Let's see who all I can invite. I'll start with my brothers. And the guest list is found in 2 Samuel 3, verses 2 through 5. I won't go with the whole family tree that's mentioned there. You can do that on your own. But in order of birth, those invited are Amnon, Kileab, Adonijah, Shephatiah, and Ithream, five brothers plus himself. Of course, that makes six. So there's part of your guest list. Others that obviously were included were those old enough to go. David had, as we've noted, close to 50 children with at least seven wives and God knows how many concubines and unnamed wives. And he kept somebody pregnant all the time. And obviously they're having children all the time. Some of them are of age. How many of the 50 are of age and therefore are invited to go up to Hazor is unknown. But I would imagine it amounted to several, maybe 15 or 20 people, in addition to those that we see in verses 2 through 5. Now there were more than just family members, point 7. In addition, Absalom decided to invite David and his entire cabinet. It's like Roger inviting Bill and Hillary and the entire administration down to Hot Springs for a party. Verse 24, Absalom went to the king and said, "Your servant has had shearers come." All right, what does that say to David? Oh, it's okay. I remember now, it's that time of year every year where you have all those sheep fellows come in and shear those sheep up at Hazor at your ranch. I remember now. You always have a party associated with that. It comes back to me now. And so he goes on to say, I'm pretending I'm David vectoring as he makes this comment to him, you see. Your servant has had shearers come. Well, that vectors all of this stuff about the party up for David. Will the king and his cabinet please join me? Now, government's going to be there. Let's have a whing ding. Point one. Sheep are sheared annually in the spring, either by the owners or by professional shearers. Well, you bet Absalom's not going to do it. So he's going to hire people to come in, which he does. It was a big operation requiring expert craftsmanship since the fleece were more profitable if kept whole. So obviously these professional boys have to be brought in to do the craftsmanship necessary to preserve the fleece whole, if at all possible, and they bring a higher price that way. Now, this operation takes a while. Point two. The conclusion of the shearing became a time of great festivals as the year's labor was celebrated by owners, workers, and friends. The conclusion of the shearing became a time of great festivals as the year's labor was celebrated by owners, workers, and friends. Three. It is to this event that Absalom refers when he says to his father, "Your servant has had shearers come." And David understands precisely what that means. Four. The invitation to join him at his Baal-Hazor ranch for the shearing refers to the big party associated with it. He's not asking David and the cabinet to come participate in the sheep shearing, but the party that always follows. And David understood that. Five. The invitation looks innocent enough, since all the brothers are invited, and David is given a special invitation that includes the entire cabinet. If you invite the entire government to Hazor, is anybody going to have it cross their mind that you're up to no good? Anybody with any power to do anything to stop a crime or to root out a crime or to witness a crime, anybody that's got any power is going to be in Hazor. So why would it cross anybody's mind that Absalom's up to something? He's invited not only David, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He has invited the entire government up there. Not only that, all of his brothers are going to go. Not just Amnon, all of them. So there can be no suspicion toward Absalom if he invites everybody, which is what he does. And so the invitation looks innocent enough since all the brothers are invited and David is given a special invitation that includes the entire cabinet. Six. Absalom hides his intrigue through good manners. He knows that David is not about to abandon Jerusalem for a party. How about this? Leave Jerusalem completely empty of any authority. The king's gone, the cabinet's gone. Of course, you're going to leave some military personnel around, but David's head of the military, nobody there to organize any situation that might occur. And so everybody of importance leaves, leaving Jerusalem undefended. Absalom knows that he's given David an invitation he cannot accept. Seven. Absalom knows David won't accept, but by inviting him, it helps remove any doubts David might have about Absalom's real intentions. You see, you got to think that David has not gone just stone dumb. Even though he is in reversionism, he hasn't lost his mind. And he is a good leader. And he becomes the greatest that Israel ever had. So we know the man's not stupid, he's not dumb, and he hasn't lost his mind. And somewhere back in the recesses of his thought, there is lurking the idea that Absalom may hold a grudge against Amnon. And he therefore has got to be, at least to some degree, looking for clues that might tell him that Absalom's up to something. Now, what has Absalom done to try to remove any of that suspicion? He's invited all the brothers to go up there. And further, he's invited David to go. And not only that, the entire government to go. If he's up to something, he's not going to do it now. Not with all of this authority around. So he knows David won't accept, but by inviting him, it helps remove any doubts David might have about Absalom's real intentions. 8. All successful conspiracies have a legitimate smokescreen, so the intentions of the conspiracy will not be evident. There must be a smokescreen, and that's what we've got here. Verse 23 and 24, they constitute the smokescreen. All successful conspiracies have a legitimate smokescreen, so the intentions of the conspiracy will not be evident. Point 9. This is a principle we noted on several occasions during our study of civil disobedience. The principle of the rhetorical veil. A rhetorical veil conceals, while it advances, a hidden agenda. A rhetorical veil conceals, while it advances, a hidden agenda. Point 10. Absalom's rhetorical veil is his good manners, including his open invitation to David. That's his rhetorical veil. We're having a party, and Daddy, I want you to come on up and be there with us. Bring the whole cabinet, and all our brothers are going to be there too. His hidden agenda is the assassination of Amnon. That's what's going on behind the smokescreen. His good manners conceal, while at the same time advance, his hidden agenda. The good manners conceal, while at the same time advance, the hidden agenda. Nobody knows what he's up to. Beware of those who smile at you and say they're going to help you. Beware of those who have never offered you anything, never offered you a helping hand, never offered you a good morning, and suddenly they want to do something for you. You've got to wonder what's going on. And this is not to be paranoid, but simply to be alert. That's all we're saying here. David should have been alert. And he should have sent some kind of contingency to Hazor, some little squadron from the military, anything, to go up there and supervise this thing from afar, at least, to see what was going on, just to be sure. The crown prince's life is at stake, and David doesn't see through the smokescreen. Point 11. David is forced to express his regrets in 2 Samuel 13, verse 25. But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, all of us should not go, as we would be too burdensome to you." Although Absalom kept urging him to attend, David kept refusing to go, but offered his blessings. Now, David is a slick-tongued rascal, too. He knows he can't leave Jerusalem, but he's using good manners with Absalom. He's not going to say, Well, son, I can't leave the government unattended down here. That sounds awful businesslike. You know, he's trying to organize a family reunion, for Pete's sakes. All the brothers are coming up. I'm invited. I can't sound like, I'm just being businesslike here. I got to stay here and work. You know, that's not what he says. He says, we would all of us go up there at your expense. It would be too burdensome for you. But I do offer you my blessings. I hope you have a safe journey back up to Hazor, and that your party comes off quite well. And that's what David says to him. All right, that's verse 25, analysis point 1. Sun Tzu, 6th century B.C., author of The Art of War, lists the following as the 5 essentials of victory. If you're involved in a battle, a campaign, warfare, he lists these 5 principles as essential for victory. Here's number 1. He will win who knows when to fight and when not to fight. Absalom knew not to fight right after the verdict came down, not guilty. Wrong time. He knew not to fight in Jerusalem. There's too much heat in Jerusalem. Too much authority. Get it done outside the city and figure out a way to do it. He eventually came down to Hazor and the party around the sheep shearing. And he bided his time for 2 years. He will win who knows when to fight and when not to fight. And back over around verse 22, that wasn't the time. Now he's decided it is. So he was able to discern that point, that principle. Point two, he will win who knows how to handle both superior and inferior forces. Who's the superior force? David and his administration. Who is the inferior force? Amnon. He knows both. We've just seen that he knew how to handle David. He manipulated David into giving approval for the party, but also offering his regrets. He's not going to go. So he knew how to handle the superior authority, the superior force. Who is David? He's just manipulated him, you can see. And we will note as we move through the passage how he understood how to manage Amnon as an inferior force. Amnon has a very definite weakness among his character traits that is going to contribute to his downfall. And Absalom knows about it, and he's going to play off of that. And he therefore knows his inferior force as well. The inferior force is Amnon. He knows how to handle that. Point three. He will win whose army is animated by the same spirit throughout all its ranks. He will win whose army is animated by the same spirit throughout all its ranks. And we will see as we move through the passage how he was able to get his men to unite in the assassination of Amnon. Four, he will win who prepared himself, waits to take the enemy unprepared. He will win who prepared himself, waits to take the enemy unprepared. And this whole deal about the party and inviting his father and the cabinet and the whole business, the brothers, this is to make Amnon unprepared. And everyone else is unprepared as well, but he knows precisely what he is doing. His plan has been developed in his own mind, and he will execute it, as we will note. And finally, number five, he will win who has military capacity and is not interfered with by the sovereign. He will win who has military capacity and is not interfered with by the sovereign. Did he neutralize David or what? He will not be interfered with by the sovereign. The sovereign has just given him his blessings. And he will have his own troops there, his bodyguards, who will execute the dirty deed for him. That will be the equivalent of his military force. There is a principle from Sun Tzu that is important to insert here, in addition to these five, and it is this. If you know the enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles. And Absalom knew those he had concluded were his enemies. He felt his father was his enemy, and he knew him and knew how to manage him. He knew that Amnon was his enemy. He had him analyzed to a T and knew how to manage him as well. He knew himself. He knew what his capabilities were. And he has placed himself in a situation where he has the approval of his father. He has his own clique there, his bodyguards, who are going to do his bidding for him. And he has an escape route 2 miles away over the Jordan River into his grandfather's kingdom, where he will seek political asylum. Got it all figured out. Point two. Although these are guidelines, the six principles I just gave you, although these are guidelines on how to manage armies in battle, some of them apply to this context, since conspiratorial plots to assassinate political leaders is a form of clandestine warfare. Although these are guidelines on how to manage armies in battle, some I say some because one of them is a little fuzzy, but really all of them apply to this context. Since conspiratorial plots to assassinate political leaders is a form of clandestine warfare. 3. Absalom knew he would not assassinate Amnon and hoped to escape if he performed the deed in Jerusalem. Absalom knew he could not assassinate Amnon and hoped to escape if he performed the deed in Jerusalem. There's too much authority down in Jerusalem, too many people who would be supportive of the primogeniture of Amnon. He's got to get in an isolated area and move everybody up to Hazor and move as many people up here as possible to make it look legitimate, but not too many that would jeopardize his plan. He invited the whole cabinet up. That would have been something if they had said, well, yeah, let's go. He'd have had to wait for another sheep shearing another 2 years later, I guess. But he bought the bait and he said, no, can't leave Jerusalem. But go ahead, I'll offer you my blessings. So that got rid of that problem. I can't do it in Jerusalem. I've picked Hazor. That's worked out fine. So he chooses his own battleground. That's a principle right out of Sun Tzu. Pick your own battleground. And the sheep ranch at Baal Hazor is, in essence, his battleground. 4. He knows how to handle David, the superior force. He knows how to handle Amnon, the inferior force. We've seen how he handled David. We'll see Amnon a little later. 5. We will note in an upcoming verse how Absalom motivated his troops, so to speak, his bodyguards in reality, how he motivated his troops so that all were committed to carrying off the assassination. So he's got all those boys working on the same page. And he's going to give them a code. There's a certain code that will be issued. And that will be the signal to perform the dirty deed. And they all understand and they all execute accordingly. 6. Absalom spent 2 years plotting details for this murder. A 2-year program. And he's got good... See, once you're convinced you got them where you want them, then you can be cool and calm and collected. And you can have good manners, and you can have people think that you've got everything just like you want it. I'm not afraid, I'm not upset, I'm not mad, I don't hate anybody, I'm getting along. When you know you got people where you want them, there's no need to show them your emotions. And he had everybody where he wanted them, he had a plan, he knew he could execute it, and he just takes 2 years to do it, that's all. He's very patient. 6 has got a second sentence. I guess I need to mention it. 6 again. Absalom spent 2 years plotting details for this murder. He uses his knowledge of Amnon's behavior patterns to set him up in a compromising situation. He knows Amnon's behavior patterns, and he selects one that he knows is going to place Amnon in a compromising situation and make it easy to assassinate him. 7. In a sense, the sovereign, King David, is neutralized when he declines the invitation to the party, and thus he cannot interfere. The sovereign, King David, is neutralized when he declines the invitation to the party, and thus cannot interfere. In addition to that, he gave his blessings on the whole thing. Have a nice trip. Have fun at the party. In other words, I don't see anything wrong with this. And David's removed any threat that he may have posed in the past from this whole circumstance. And he's also removed the presence of any higher authority going along. Everybody in the cabinet has to stay here. 8. Absalom knows his father David well, a man whom he considers his role model. But because of iconoclastic arrogance, he now considers his enemy. Loved his father at one time, considered him his role model and his hero. Now he's the enemy, along with Amnon. 9. Absalom's manipulation of David can be seen in verse 25, where we see David's rationale for offering his regrets. I don't want to put a burden on you. And so, point 10, David refuses because he does not want such a large guest list to be a burden on Absalom. More to it than that, point 11. This not only shows David's thoughtfulness, which he was, but also shows an unstated reason which comes from David's sense of responsibility. Because he blew it with Amnon doesn't mean that he's not a responsible person at times. When you're in reversionism, you still can be responsible from time to time while functioning in your day-to-day duties. It's just you're not consistent. And no one ever knows when you're going to get the job done and when you aren't. And so David has this strange sense underlying him of a responsibility. So 12, he cannot allow the cabinet to go and leave Jerusalem ungoverned. He can't go and leave the army without leadership. How can Jerusalem be protected? He's head of the army. The government goes. He goes. Jerusalem is left undefended in many, many ways. So they would leave it without any leadership. 13. This is circa 1000 B.C. It would take several days to complete the 180-mile circuit from Jerusalem to Baal Hazor and back. Let's say you were able to do 30 miles a day. It's just 3 days to get there, 3 days back. He's out of town for almost a week, and we haven't taken time out for the party yet. How long will that last? So a week to 10 days is how long this would be out of Jerusalem, and he can't do this. And Absalom knew that. So it would take several days to complete the 180-mile circuit from Jerusalem to Baal Hazor and back. 14. Absalom knows that David simply will not permit so many important people to leave the government unattended with no way of recalling them on short notice. 3 days is not short notice. And if a courier were to come into the ranch up at Baal Hazor during the party, we've got problems down in Jerusalem. We need your immediate return. He's 3 days away at 30 miles a day. Remember on the Santa Fe Trail, the average progress a day pulling those wagons was 8-point-something miles. On some days, they made it into the 20s when things were rolling. And so when you're on horseback, I guess you could spur them, and you could get the job done in short order, maybe 2 days, but that's a long time when a city is under siege. So we see how Absalom has backed his father into a corner on accepting this invitation. 15. In order to sell his deception, Absalom continues to plead with his father to come to his party. He wants him to truly believe that he wants him to come to the party. Oh, come on, Dad. You can do it just for a few days. We see it in verse 25. Although Absalom kept urging him to attend, David kept refusing to go, but he did offer his blessings. He's driving the point home, Absalom is, that he really wants his father to come. And that's removing any doubts in David's mind that Absalom's up to something. So in order to sell his deception, Absalom continues to plead with his father to come to his party. 16. In this way, he conceals while he advances his hidden agenda. And the hidden agenda in this particular context is to keep David out of Baal Hazor. What's the rhetorical veil? Pleading repeatedly that David come up there. What's the hidden agenda? Convincing that you're honest, having just a family reunion and nothing out of sorts is going on. I know that under his responsibilities, he will not go. But I'm driving the point home, it's just a family reunion. So 17, by offering an invitation, Absalom knows David will not accept, but insisting continually that he do so, helps remove any suspicion his father might be having about his motives. Offering the invitation he knows he can't accept, but continually pleading with him to do so, it helps remove any suspicion his father might be having about his motives. 18, in the end, David declines the invitation, but wishes his son well on his trip back to Baal Hazor. Point 19. After it becomes clear that David will not attend, Absalom is then free to play his brotherhood card. Now he's free to play his second card in his deck. This is the brotherhood card. He convinces David that he at least can let the crown prince attend, since all the other brothers will be there as well. Obviously, the crown prince had duties in Jerusalem with the government. He was probably in training to take David's place at some point, and he was considered part of the cabinet. And therefore, since all the brothers were invited, and Amnon included, Absalom wants to make sure that of the cabinet, Amnon will be released. At least Amnon will be able to go and be with the other brothers at the bonfire. So he convinces David to let at least Amnon go to the party along with the other brothers. That brings us to 2 Samuel 13:26. Absalom said, "If not, then please permit Amnon, my brother, to come with us." And the king said, "Well, why should he go with you?" We'll find out why, oddly enough, on Sunday morning. Father, we are grateful to you for the privilege of noting these things this evening. It is our prayer that this study might contribute to our progress in understanding iconoclastic arrogance and all of the other syndromes and trends that go along with it. May it be a part of our soul inventory that we might continue our advance in your perfect plan, unhindered by such activities as these. And we lift our prayer in the name of Christ, our Savior. Amen.